From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined with our super producer, Paul, Mission Control, Deckett. Most importantly, you are you. You are here. And that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. It's quite possible that some of us listening to the show today or tonight are listening in a hotel or a motel or an Airbnb.
A Holiday Inn, perhaps.
Sure, perhaps.
Or an Express Holiday Inn.
Or a Best Western or Go Classy, maybe a Westin.
Ooh, Nights in
something ritzy like the Ritz.
Or a Hilton.
Yes.
The hotel we're going to be speaking about today is currently a Hilton property.
Yes.
Perhaps Nights in White Satin.
It's true.
Yes.
You know, that song's actually not about nights at all. It's about like nights as in the evening. Nights bathed and dressed in white satin. Just realized that pretty recently. Unrelated.
But it's true. There are all sorts of strange things that happen in hotels. Similar to spending time in an airport, spending time in a hotel is occupying a limbo, a liminal space. It looks like a home. You do things that you would do in a home, but it's not really a home. There's something uncanny valley about it. And today's story is about a very strange, extraordinary thing that occurred in a hotel. And we don't mean extraordinary in the way it's often misused. Today, usually extraordinary is meant as a compliment, but actually extraordinary just means something out of the ordinary.
And that is the way we are using it today.
So let's set the scene. On January the 2nd, 1935, a well-dressed young man calling himself Roland T. Owen walks into the hotel president in Kansas City, Missouri. The man is not carrying luggage. He's heavy set. He appears to be a fighter of some sort, or at least someone who's had experience fighting, because he has a visible cauliflower ear and a horizontal scar on the left side of his face.
Quick cauliflower ear thing. You'll see this if you Google images of a lot of MMA fighters. You can see what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. And it's a very easy thing to spot, right?
Mm-hmm.
This man, calling himself Roland T. Owen, requests a single room with no windows facing the street. He pays cash, which you could do at that time, right? Which was the normal way to pay for things.
In 1935,
and he checks into room 1046. When the cleaning staff goes by his room, you know, to change the sheets, change out the towels and stuff, they find the man calling himself Roland T. Owen sitting in a dark room, exhibiting signs of profound fright. He tells the staff that he's expecting someone to drop by.
So, okay, so far, what we know, scared guy sitting, you know, alone in a room that he wanted to stay away, or he wanted to be a little more anonymous than usual, hiding out in a hotel. But it's, you know, it's mysterious, but it's not all that insane, right?
Yeah, it's a little Blair Witchy, though. It reminds me of, like, the dude standing facing the corner in the Blair Witch, you know?
Okay.
It's like, and on its surface, it's not that weird, but when you know a little more about the backstory, it becomes even weirder.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And to explore this story, we're going to shift through various different perspectives, primarily people who work at the hotel. So first, what do you say? Let's start with the maid's tale, if we want to make this Canterbury Tale-esque.
Or a Hulu original, maybe.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. The non-handmaid's tale.
That's right. So at 10:30 in the morning on January 3rd, the day after our protagonist, I guess, Roland T. Owen, checks into the President Hotel.
A man calling himself Roland T. Owen.
That's right. A member of the cleaning staff goes up to room 1046 where he is. She notices that the door is locked and she, you know, it's kind of a normal thing. Doors are locked when the cleaning staff comes by. Mm-hmm. They knock generally and say housekeeping. She opens the door and because she assumes that Owen is out maybe at breakfast or having a meeting or something.
Because she notices the lights are off too.
Exactly. Lights are off, door is locked, I'm going to clean this room. Well, instead, as she opens the door, as we said earlier, she sees him sitting alone in the dark. Yes, you heard that correctly. Just sitting there in the dark. Now, before you say all that is so insane, I just have to bring up a fact that I enjoy doing this a lot, actually.
Is it unusual to do that?
I don't think it's that unusual.
I'm right there with you. I spend hours each week, actually, in locked in a bathroom in the dark with the shower on, just sort of thinking.
Nice. I definitely take showers in the dark when I can.
Am I the outlier here? I think I'm the outlier here.
Oh, yeah?
Am I the only one that finds this strange?
I don't know. I got into it when I was a kid. We had a drum kit in this room that had no windows in it in my parents' basement. And I would go in there, shut the door, and like use a flashlight or something, or turn the light on, go sit down at my throne, and then turn off all the lights and just practice playing drums in the pitch black. And I found it to be riveting. I just like to do things like that.
Didn't you have a similar setup with your drum kit in your last house too?
I did, but it was in a basement with one window.
I don't know, man. That basement, when I went down there, it felt like a kill room.
Yeah?
And I have a very high tolerance for strangeness.
I think that was just the factor of the basement itself. Having the drum kit was just a nice little accoutrement.
Were the walls covered in plastic?
Sometimes.
Yeah. Okay.
When, you know, when season was right.
You are not digging yourself out of this hole of weirdness very well.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay.
So it sounds like two-thirds of us are on board with this. He might have also been dozing off or sleeping. That's quite possible, right? But the maid is standing there, you know, she notices or senses somehow this person sitting in this room, and she realizes the room is in fact occupied. And then Roland pretty much tells her not to touch the lights, and he asks the maid to leave the door unlocked as she exits because, you see, he says he is, again, expecting someone. So this is the second time he said this.
And then according to a Mental Floss article that's written on this very subject, it says that the maid ended up returning to that room to deliver fresh towels. And this time when she went in, she found Owen lying on his bed now. He's fully dressed, but there's a note on the desk that read, "Dawn, I will be back in 15 minutes. Wait." And that's Dawn spelled D-O-N.
Yes.
So now we've got Dawn. We've got another person in the mix.
Is that like Donald or the Dawn?
Oh my God, Matt! Right. I never thought about that. This is gonna come back around.
Yeah, this does come back around, and that's a good question. Is it kind of the thing? Is it kind of like saying Sir? You know what I mean? Or Duke? Now we shift to the story of the motorist. Later on the same night, January 3rd. There's a guy named Robert Lane. That is his real name. He's not a guy who calls himself that. And he is driving. He picks up a stranger a few blocks away from the hotel president.
So the man was dressed only in pants and like an undershirt. And he had a scar on his left arm. Not an open wound, but like a big, very obvious kind of gash of a scar, and that was on his left arm. And then when Lane told his passenger that he looked as if he was having a rough night, the man replied, "I will kill that beep tomorrow." And this beep comes honestly by this beep, because the reports about this in the newspaper of the time in the area, they removed this word, and it's not clear what it actually was.
Well, and this guy, Robert Lane, that we're talking about, he worked for the water department in Kansas City. So it's not like he was just some random guy out there. He was doing his job when he interacted.
Right. And I have a proposition for the table, for the show. I have a proposition. We do not know what expletive he used, and we don't know exactly what the newspapers decided to censor. We may not ever know it.
Yeah.
But I stumbled across this great anachronistic, and I think I said this to you, Noel, this great anachronistic insult.
I love this so much, Ben.
So what if instead of saying, you know, whatever, gutter tramp, I don't know, whatever weird thing you want to put in there, what if he said, "I'll kill that sockdologizing old man trap tomorrow.
Soctologizing old man traps.
The old man trap.
You old man trap. I don't know why that tickles me, but you're right. You're right. He did work for the water department, and then later, when he's given the opportunity to identify this hitchhiker, who, as you said, Noel, was only in pants and an undershirt, looking like he had been rode hard and put away wet, he said, yeah, that's the guy I picked up. And they said, that guy is Roland T. Owen, or at least that's what he calls himself.
Now, on this same night, January 3rd, just a quick mention, he was allegedly seen around the town at several bars, hanging out with at least two women, like that night, seen hanging around doing stuff with them. The timelines are a little bit weird, just a little bit, but they say he was on 12th Street, which, you know, isn't that far, because we're our last person, our Robert Lane, he actually interacted with Roland T. Owen along 13th Street, which is about a mile and a half from the hotel. So, you know, 12th Street distance is not that far from there, right?
All right. So it's completely plausible that he could be in that area, that there could be some sand to those reports, which did not have they didn't get widely publicized. If I'm correct, they were sort of hearsayers, some rumors.
Yeah.
And we should also mention that the cleaning staff, the member of the cleaning staff, her name was Mary Soptic.
Yes.
So speaking of staff, and we are building a case here. We are going somewhere with this, folks. I know we're taking a circuitous route. But speaking of staff, let's go to the first bellboy. Whose name we don't have.
Yeah. So Bellboy 1 interacts around 7 a.m. with our protagonist. It's January the 4th. The phone operator at Hotel President, because, you know, there's an entire system of phone lines going to all the different rooms. There's actually a human being in 1935 that is operating these phones. This operator notices that the receiver, the telephone in 1046, where Roland is staying, is off the hook. And so this bellboy goes up to check on Owen, and or at least to check up on the phone itself. And when he gets there, he finds that the door's locked, and there's a do not disturb sign hanging from the knob. It probably says something like, nary a disturbance, something like that. He knocks, and he hears somebody from the other side of the room say,
come in.
And again, he's like, door's locked. Hello? Door's locked. Man inside the room just kind of ignores that he's letting him know that the door is locked. But then the guy says,
turn on the lights.
Kind of hard to do that when you can't get into the room. Bellboy just keeps on knocking, but he ends up just leaving. But right before he leaves, he shouts through the door.
He wants him to put his phone on the hook, right?
Yeah.
I'll do the voice. Put your damn phone on the hook, son. Because it's Hank Hill. That's the bellhop.
Yes. Yeah.
It's an approximation of what occurred. But yes, he just like yells at him to put the phone back on the hook. And the bellboy just doesn't have his pass key on him at that moment, so he can't go in and do it. So he just kind of gives up and goes downstairs.
An hour's pass. Let's go to the second bellboy. A different member of the hotel staff goes up later that afternoon. So it's 7 a.m. January 4th. When he has the first guy has that weird interaction. In the afternoon, this different guy goes up, and he does have his key on him, so he lets himself into the room, and he finds the man calling himself Roland T. Owen lying on the bed in the dark. And from what he could tell, this man was very much naked and very much drunk. He also sees that the phone stand has been knocked over. So he doesn't turn on the lights. He doesn't say anything to this naked man reeking of booze. He just hangs up the phone, cuts his losses, leaves the room.
Because at this point, it's been hours and hours. The operator is like, somebody, hang up that phone. I need order. I'm the operator here. Hang up that phone. So that bellboy just did it and got out.
And we have two more perspectives that are crucial to understanding this mystery. We'll get back to those after a word from our sponsor. So we have our first returning, a recurring guest star here in this strange tale. The first bellboy comes back.
Yeah, as well as the phone operator.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I should give her more credit.
Do you think she was a smooth operator?
One would hope, yeah.
Guaranteed.
Because yeah. She runs a tight ship. She doesn't like phones being off the hook.
That's right.
In her hotel.
That's mm-hmm. right.
Because when we were talking about this, Matt, I was sort of like, man, very particular. Because, I mean, some people might take the phone off the hook so they won't be disturbed. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't it be kind of an affront to be disturbed for trying to not be disturbed?
That's a good question.
Agreed.
It also may be a situation where, given phone technology at the time, having one thing off the hook could mess up the line for other patrons.
Yeah, and you got to wonder, too, was it like a safety concern? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where like they would want to be able to reach you or let you know if there was a problem. Or I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what was the urgency with sending a physical human to knock on the door pretty aggressively, if you ask me.
Maybe she, heard this crazy noise. On the old switchboard, and she was like, get this guy out of my ear holes.
But she didn't want to say what she was hearing.
She didn't want to say what she heard. Yeah,
she is the best witness that we have yet to really even discuss that we don't have information about. We need someone to go back to 1935 and interview the phone operator.
Yes.
If you have your time machine, John Titor.
Yeah, right.
Help.
So, like you said, she's pretty ardent about this. All phones shall be either in use or they darn well better be hooked and on their proper stand. So she's a bit of a stickler, perhaps. She sends one of the staff members up to check this out. He opens the door. He's got his key on him. And then he finds the man calling himself Roland T. Owen, still naked, still nude, but viciously brutalized. Someone has beaten the tar out of him, and he is on the edge of death. Of course, the hotel calls the cops. The cops find blood spatters festooning the walls, the bed, the bathroom. Roland T. Owen, the guy who calls himself that, appears to have been tortured. So not just roughed up, but maliciously, purposefully victimized, with an emphasis more on making things painful rather than just immediately killing the guy.
Because he was stabbed, I believe, dozens of times, very shallowly, which would show you that it was something to keep him alive in order to maybe make him talk or just mm-hmm. extend that pain as much as possible.
Yeah, good observation, right? Because it's very messy to kill someone with a knife, but it's very easy. So whomever it was, they knew what they were doing, and they did not want to immediately kill him. His skull was also fractured from what appeared to be a series of intense impacts from a blunt object. Somehow, old boy is still alive, at least for a second.
And goodness gracious, did he have a strong desire to cover up who had done this to him. He literally said something along the lines of, I tripped and fell, onto a knife repeatedly.
Yeah.
Very strange thing to say.
He was trying to protect something, right?
Or somebody else. Or,
what he had done. Like, perhaps if the police knew who did this to him, they might know something that he had done. So maybe it was self-preservation. Or maybe he's protecting a third party.
Or maybe he was involved in criminal activity. I mean, that's what you would think if you're law enforcement and someone said, I slipped and fell. And maybe he was just like, I'm not a rat,
That could be it.
He also could have been completely insane from the pain and torture and just, and probably had undergone some brain damage from being, kicked in the head. I mean, if he had a serious fracture there.
Well, that's almost certain. Because the next thing that happens to Roland is he slips into a coma.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't make it through the night.
Yeah, he's not in the coma for long. He dies that evening. So this brings us to today's question. What happened to the man calling himself Roland T. Owen? Here's where it gets crazy. It turns out there is no Roland T. Owen matching the description of this corpse. There are several people with the name Roland Owen in the world at this time and in the United States, and there are plenty of dead people who have that name, but none of them are this person. Roland T. Owen cannot be identified, and so law enforcement takes a tact that may be surprising to some of us here in 2019. I've never heard of this happening in the modern day. What do they do?
Okay, so yes, this is very strange. And we've all talked about this off mic, how I don't think any of us have ever heard of this exact technique for identifying somebody.
For other John Does, I've never heard of this. Tell us what it is.
Yeah, they literally propped him up in a funeral home like window, which is one of the most macabre things I've ever seen. First of all, if I was walking down the street and saw that with my kids or something like that, I would consider that a personal affront.
Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't be like, oh, look, it's Steve. I'd be like, Jesus, what is that? Get me out of here. Mommy, no. And it's not a good thing. Not a good look. But yeah, they do this and it actually yields some hits, right?
Yeah. Several people around the area do recognize Roland T. Owen from various encounters with him while he was on this side of the veil, but none of them know him as anything other than Roland. And the police are, at this point, we should add, the police are befuddled and they think that there's something else at play, something beyond the mundane, although horrific, tragedy of homicide. Because we didn't mention this, when they found Owen, right, we said he was naked, but his hotel room had also been ransacked. There were no towels, no shampoo. He didn't have any clothes in the room. He had a label for a necktie, a hairpin, a cigarette, a safety pin, and a small sealed bottle of sulfuric acid.
What? Right? Like, why? What are you doing with that acid, man? Well, then also, don't they find a broken glass of some sort somewhere?
In the sink with the jagged edge. And the only prints they found, because they didn't have fingerprint technology in the 1930s, came from the telephone stand. And the police, for some reason, correct us if you're a forensic expert, but the police, for some reason, say, well, these were the fingerprints of a woman.
Is that profiling? But I guess it would be if it's police officers trying to, I don't know.
Maybe that's, the person just had dainty hands.
Who knows? Mm-hmm. Okay.
So people could identify his body. Some knew him as Roland, but other people knew him by different names. You know, we don't have those names today, but I'm like, oh, that's Alvin or Alfonso or Beauregard. I don't know. And it turned out he stayed in more than one hotel before he stayed at the Hotel President. There was another hotel called the Muehlbach Hotel, and they knew him as Eugene K. Scott.
Yeah, they said he like stayed there for one night, and that was it.
And didn't want windows facing the street.
Yeah. What is he up to? He also stayed at the St. Regis. That's another nice hotel in the area. And this time, his name. Now, this is going to be. We don't want to spoil too much, but his name. Or he called himself Duncan Ogletree at that hotel, and he shared a room with another man who was known as Donald Kelso. There's our Don.
Don. Is that our Don? Don, yeah. Donald Kelso? Then there was a wrestling promoter who said that Owen, remember, looked like a fighter, had approached him a few weeks earlier and said, I'd like to sign up for some wrestling matches, but don't call me Roland T. Owen. My name is Cecil Warner.
Cecil Warner.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So, all right, now I'm getting a little more of a picture. I'm assuming everyone listening, all of us have heard of these, I guess, smaller wrestling matches or more localized wrestling matches.
Sure.
That can range from like family-friendly to the macabre,
yeah,
essentially. Now I'm imagining all these like shallow cuts on him.
Oh,
and
yeah,
injuries to his head.
Uh-huh.
If he's a local wrestler that maybe takes things too far. But we'll get into that a little later.
Yeah, this not entirely related or tangentially related at best, but have you guys ever seen those kind of local wrestling matches?
Oh, yeah.
I've been to a few. Yeah.
When I was a kid.
I saw one where the blood was definitely real and these guys were not faking it. All due respect to the kayfabe or whatever they call it in WWE, but these guys were actually beating the snot out of each other.
The one that I went to was super theatrical in the sense that, like, the bad guy was often some sort of foreigner. I'm doing quotation fingers. Yeah, and the good guy was, like, swathed in, like, an American flag or something like that. Mm. And there was some real hooting and hollering from the stands. It was out in the country, out in rural Georgia.
Ooh, it was a, buddy.
It was a real experience.
Were we friends? Have we met when you went?
It was pretty recently.
Okay.
It was like last year.
Okay, yeah, because I feel like I remember that story. I would still go check out one of those matches. But yeah, maybe he was involved in something related to wrestling, to fixing a match, right? Or something with organized crime. Or
participating in a match.
Mm-hmm. But that's the thing. The police are at their wits' end due to the circumstances of the discovery and the circumstances of this man's death. They say they need to identify him because they have the feeling that this may be a breadcrumb leading to something much, much, much more sinister. And they put his body on display and they take out an ad,
yeah.
Take out ads telling people to help and to show up at this funeral home for the viewing. Hundreds of people go. And as we said, a lot of them know this guy under various different names. And far be it for me to criticize anybody for traveling under different names.
Well, a lot of it goes back to that scar that he had on the left side of his face.
Right, and the ear.
And the ear, because it's just something, like you said earlier, Ben, you just would recognize that.
So people are following this story in the local papers of the time, and the million-dollar question is, who the hell is this? Eventually, people just throw up their hands and say, you know, we tried our best, you can't win them all. They make plans to bury the body of the man calling himself Roland T. West and Eugene and Cecil and so on in an unmarked grave at a potter's field. And a potter's field is where bodies will be interned if they have no survivors to take care of them, or if they have no funds or no will, or they can't be identified.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's go back to when the news article comes out where they're announcing, here's this unidentified person. Let us know if you've heard of this person before. An anonymous person, a woman, calls the local paper and she says that somebody, somewhere, some anonymous person is going to pay for a proper funeral for this person known as Roland. And when the local paper inquires about, well, hey, do you know what happened to him or why he ended up in this state? She says, quote, he got into a jam.
Got into a jam. Who is this? Dennis Reynolds? This
yes.
is like a Dennis Reynolds description.
He got all jammed up.
Want to get jammed up, buddy?
Oh, boy.
But seriously, that's a strange thing to say, right?
Mm-hmm.
And shortly afterwards, another person calls in anonymously. This time it's a man, and they call the funeral home, and he confirms that he'll be paying for the funeral of this person calling themselves Roland T. Owen. And he has some conditions along with his payment and says, not only will I pay for the funeral, but he is going to be is my wish that he be buried in this specific cemetery. And then he says,
he'll be near my sister.
The man mentioned specifically Memorial Park Cemetery. And if we were to paraphrase, he tells law enforcement that Roland had jilted a girl that he, the unidentified caller, had planned to marry, and that the three of them had met up at the Hotel President.
Ooh.
And the caller says,
cheaters usually get what's coming to them. I'm not sure why they're all Southern, but
it's just more fun to
say.
It's a fun one to do.
I think we're just feeling it.
I think we're feeling it today.
And we would need to put in some more research to really give a Missouri accent.
Yeah,
to proper
I don't know what that would be. Kansas City. That's
what people call you, right? They call you Kansas City?
Yep.
So he hangs up right after he says cheaters usually get what's coming to them. Dial tone noise, the whole nine. Multiple unidentified people send flowers to the funeral. One order for flowers, $5 worth of flowers, has a card attached. And it says, love forever, Louise, L-O-U-I-S-E. And then time passes. It isn't until 1936 when a woman from Birmingham, Alabama, reads an account of this unsolved murder in the magazine American Weekly. And hey, she thinks, it's fairly apparent in the article that this guy's name was not Roland T. Owen.
Yeah.
Nor was it any of the other names he used, most likely. So this lady says this corpse might be the missing child of my good friend. He left home in April of 1934, but his name isn't Roland.
And we'll tell you what his name is after a word from our sponsor.
All right, ready for this? Artemis Ogletree.
Ah, you recall Ogletree from earlier?
Duncan Ogletree, yeah.
Yes. Okay, interesting.
So the woman who finds this article in American Weekly, she reaches out to Artemis's mother, Mrs. Ogletree, and she goes on, the mother, to positively confirm the body of Roland T. Owen as that of her son. And law enforcement says, all right, we believe you. We agree with your claim. The timeline checks out. This is your son. We have finally identified this victim. It is Artemis Ogletree. He had left home. He had left Alabama in April of 1934, ostensibly to travel to California. But it's weird because for some time, the family, the Ogletree family, thought he was completely fine. You see, sometime after Ogletree's physical death, the family had received two letters from Artemis. Two typewritten letters after his murder where he claimed everything was fine. Don't worry about him. Plans have changed. He's now traveling the world.
Oh, wow.
So they did not know he was dead, but he certainly didn't write these letters.
That's right, because generally when the mother had received letters from her son, they were all handwritten in a very specific handwriting that her son uses. These typed out letters were much more formal than what she was used to receiving, which definitely made them, or at least set them apart and made her a bit suspicious about them. Then, before the mother actually found out that the son was dead, she had received a phone call from some man, some, I guess, anonymous person, but this person called themselves Jordan.
This is so weird.
Yeah, and he claimed, Jordan claimed that Artemis was now living in Cairo, Egypt, had become married to some, at least unknown to the mother, wealthy woman, and that everything was okay. And he was just, he was living out his life now in Cairo.
Yeah, it's very strange. So the authorities said, let's not push our luck. We'll settle for identifying the body.
Yeah.
You know, this, we may never identify the murderer or the murderers, but it's amazing that we were able to bring closure to this grisly, grisly story. So these letters, by the way, said various different things. One said he was in Chicago. One said he was sailing from New York to Europe. These, it appeared as though they were real-time updates. And at this point, we can try to go a bit further than the police went. We don't have to settle for just identifying the body. You see, in the decades, almost a century of time since the discovery of the murder and the death of Artemis Ogletree, hundreds of thousands of people have been working the case, attempting to figure out what actually happened to this poor, unfortunate young man. And they've built some pretty interesting theories here.
Was it a jilted lover situation? We've talked about those possibilities. Mm-hmm. Did the unidentified male caller have a part in Ogletree's murder?
We're talking about Jordan.
Yeah, that's right. Was one of Was he possibly one of Louise's siblings, a relative of some kind? Mm-hmm. Was Memorial Park Cemetery a place where Ogletree's spurned lover could visit her grave? My question there, though, is why bury your enemy next to the person who he wronged, who you did him in for?
It feels like a mob move.
It feels like a mob move, or a kind of a twisted, some sort of weird vengeance kind of thing, mm-hmm. like where it's like a power move. I don't know. It's very, very weird.
It's like, Luis, you're my sister. I love you, but I cannot let this disrespect go unpunished.
There you go. Well, let's get back into just the concept of the jilted lover's theory here. Mm-hmm. So what we do know, or at least what we have heard here throughout the story, is that perhaps Ogletree was in the middle of some kind of love triangle. Mm-hmm. And the question then is whether or not – like which side of the triangle he's on essentially.
Right.
Was he betrothed to someone and he messed up? Was his partner – messing up in some way, doing something with someone else, or was the other person like the husband or something to that effect? So, and there's really no way for us to know for sure like what that situation was, and it's difficult to go down all the different paths and try to figure that out. But we do know that this Don character was somehow in his room, involved in some way. At least there would be more information there if you could find it with this person. And the other Louise is a possibility, and then you've got the fingerprints. I would say that's one of the more promising theories.
One of the more promising avenues, yeah. Mm-hmm. There's another thing that occurs in 1937. There's a guy named Joseph Ogden. That's the alias. Mm-hmm. He never says his real name, and the police don't believe him. He is arrested for the murder of his roommates. Turns out Joseph Ogden is not this guy's only AKA. He's also been known to go under the moniker of Donald Kelso.
Uh-oh.
And his description matches the description of the Donald Kelso who had stayed at the St. Regis with Artemis when he was going by the name Duncan Ogletree.
Dude. But again, here's the deal. This, I guess there wasn't much else to learn here, or it was just never pursued for one reason or another, so we don't know anything more about this lead. And then let's bring in Jordan, the caller you brought up. Could this guy have actually, like that caller who called himself Jordan, could that have also been Kelso / Ogden, whoever that guy was? And was he just trying to cover his tracks by saying, oh, he's off in Cairo somewhere. Don't worry about him. He's fine. But either way, this person, Jordan, this caller, made himself very suspicious.
Right, because all we know about this caller is that they called themselves Jordan. That's it. They didn't present identification or a birth certificate or anything like that. And frankly, we have two people who were definitely using multiple fake names, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kelso and Ogletree. We don't really know why they were using these fake names. And that I think is a fascinating twist to this tale, because that's something they don't want you to know. And it was much easier to travel under an assumed name at the time. This has caused some people, and you can find these in various like independent investigation threads or the excellent subreddit, Unresolved Mysteries, various people have, due to the secrecy and the fact that he was traveling at one point with another guy, they've said perhaps he was assuming a false identity to pursue a same-sex relationship, which would have been very controversial at that time.
Absolutely.
But in all fairness, there's not a whole lot – like there's no proof that that was not the case. But there's not really any proof that it was the case. So that's clearly speculation.
Absolutely. It could be, sure, but who knows. Well, the other big question is, was there any kind of drug involvement one way or the other in use or in sales perhaps?
Yeah, I don't see how – I mean, I kind of almost lump that in with any potential mob connection, right? It could have certainly been part and parcel of the same kind of toxic relationship, you know?
It seemed like he was drinking very, very heavily, at least by the time he got to Hotel President.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't know about the other stuff.
Well, so, okay, so using assumed names because you're doing something, you're involved in some kind of illegal activity, that's why you don't want it to be known who you actually are. That's what we're saying. I mean, I can imagine that. There's a, isn't it kind of known that in Kansas City, Missouri, around the 1930s, organized crime was a thing?
Oh yeah, this might be surprising to some of us listening, but it's true. The Kansas City crime family, also known as the Civella crime family, is a mafia outfit based in Kansas City, Missouri. They've been there since 1912, when the founders, the DiGiovanni brothers, fled Sicily and landed in Kansas City, Missouri.
Wow! Now,
I don't know about you guys, but when I think of Kansas City, I think of stuff like barbecue, or maybe there's some great art museums, but I don't immediately think of the mob.
I'm just going to admit that I don't think about Kansas City, Missouri enough, and I vow to think about it more.
You take that vow very seriously, Matt.
I am.
You can't vow lightly, sir.
All right.
I'm going to quiz you on Kansas City in a week's time.
All right, do it.
I just know there was a place, I think in New York, called Max's Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And it was not in Kansas City. That's all I know about Kansas City.
A restaurant?
I think it's like a, it was a famous music venue.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
Well, here's the weird thing. Not only is the mob a force to be reckoned with in Kansas City, Missouri, but they had a lot of para-governmental control, meaning that, you know, you've heard the stories. We also have a great story I've got to tell you guys off air to see if we can get it on the show. But we've asked some of your fellow listeners before to send in stories about small-town corruption. Kansas City, while it's not a small town, in the turn of the century, in the early 1900s, there is a lot of rank corruption. Prohibition ended in 1933. So just like a few years before Artemus Ogletree meets his untimely end, and the family made a lot of coin off prohibition, but they also diversified. So they have different rackets, protection money from bars and restaurants, right? And things get ugly. They're involved in politics too, you know, cooking the books in the race for governor of Missouri and things like that. So it is completely possible that when we add up these dots, these mm-hmm. breadcrumbs, it's completely possible that there's an argument for a criminal underground or the mob.
Can I add one extra thing on top of this mob connection? Because I can totally see this reasoning, and we've illuminated it pretty well. What if he's on the other side of the law? What if he and Don, or maybe just he, was actually an agent of some sort that was investigating some of the organized crime, and that's why he ended up getting taken out? And then it's the mob connections that are arranging his funeral, or, you know, paying for his funeral, putting him by his sister. What if he was a rat?
Maybe. I mean, the cops did hold that funeral, right?
Yeah.
There was a funeral service, but the detectives on the case were the only people who attended the funeral.
Aha.
Which also makes you think, you know what I mean? Because if it's just a case, why would you go to the funeral?
To case the joint to see if anybody shows up.
Right, to see if someone takes the bait. Right?
Or if he's a part of your team.
Or if he's, you know, if he's one of those undercover cops. People who work undercover at that kind of level of intelligence, it's a brutal life. And, you know, a lot of times they're never in the spotlight. They can't compromise.
It's true.
I'm thinking Ben, of The Wire.
It's true, Ben.
Thanks, Matt. Are we just going to keep saying each other's names with increasing sarcasm?
State Department.
Hey, you guys
actor.
Be nice.
All right. So
break it up, you two.
So it is true. It's not proof positive, but it is true that the Kansas mob could and did murder multiple people in this time period without a ton of interference from regional or federal authorities, some because they were bought off or they were already in the thick of the corruption,
yep.
and others because their hands were tied.
Wow. All right.
So is that the end of the story? Not really. And this is very strange because we have to ask ourselves whether a cover-up persists You see, decades and decades later, there's a researcher based at the Kansas City Public Library. And like a lot of residents or residents of Missouri or residents of Kansas City, this researcher has a hobby. They look into these kind of cases. So they are familiar with the case of Artemis Ogletree. They receive an anonymous phone call, and the caller first starts asking questions. Have you heard of the Ogletree case? Have you heard of the person calling themselves Roland T. Owen? And they say, yes, I'm familiar with it. I'm a researcher. And then this anonymous caller says that they had someone who's close to them pass away. And they've been going through the belongings of this person because they had died quite recently, and they found a box. Within this box, there were multiple newspaper clippings all about the same story, the so-called mystery of Room 1046. But that's not all they find. They also say they find something. That's the quote. Something that was mentioned in these articles. And then they hang up. These people have terrible phone etiquette, by
the way. Really?
It's like how in television and in film, no one ever says goodbye on the phone.
Yeah, and there's immediately a dial tone.
Yeah, it's true.
Which, as we know, is not how phones work.
Yeah, that's right. So that's where we're left at this point. In 2019, the old Artemis Ogletree, Rowan T. Owen story, that's where we're left.
Who was this mystery caller? Was it a surviving relative of Ogletree's murderer? A surviving relative or friend of his former lover, his paramour? What do you think?
Honestly, do you think it was mob involvement? Do you think it was just a love triangle gone wrong? Just tell us. Tell us your best theory and support it, please, with arguments. Then we will combine all of those, and Ben and Noel and I will sit around a desk somewhere and we'll figure it out. just to ourselves. We won't tell you guys about it.
And also, if you are listening to this and you are related to someone with inside knowledge of this case and you want to break it down for us anonymously, we'd love to hear you out. You can write to us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram.
We're Conspiracy Stuff and or Conspiracy Stuff Show in those places. If you don't want to do that and you want to tell your story in 3-minute bursts, you can call our number. We are 1-833-STDWYTK. Leave a message. I've got it up on my phone again, so I'm like going through them and putting more stuff out. Did you guys hear the really weird message we got?
I haven't listened yet.
All right, well, you should listen to it. Okay. It's pretty fun.
Is it weird?
It's great. It's somebody fantastic. Out there has a great sense of humor. You'll hear it soon.
It immediately made me want to do another listener call-in episode.
Yeah.
We have exactly. A treasure trove. We also have, the three of us also have personal Instagrams if you want to follow our individual adventures.
Yeah, mine is at Embryonic Insider.
I am at Ben Bullen.
And mine is at Sitting in the Dark Alone.
Playing drums.
All just pictures of Matt sitting in the dark alone.
So yeah, in the dark, no lights.
They look really dark.
It's just really, really dark.
You have to turn the sound on, right?
Yeah, that's it. Oh, you just hear me breathing.
That's what the kids call a weird flex.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, there we go. And if none of that quite bags your badgers, if you're tired of social media, you hate being on the phone, but you want to tell us something about this case or something fascinating from your neck of the global woods, we are all ears, or in this case, eyes. You can write to us directly. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.